understand our complexities and understand how we use our complexities as a way to leverage power. We're ultimately here to figure out how is it that we transform conditions in this country so that we can transform the conditions in our world.
You are three powerful women. Did you ever think the Black Lives Matter movement would take off in this way?
I think that we are all deeply, deeply committed to the liberation of Black people. And so when you put people together who have and share that commitment, the sky is the limit. And, you know, we operate with an incredible, incredible team that is networked throughout 26 chapters across the world. And this movement would not be possible. This kind of excitement and the generation of energy would not be possible without a brilliant, courageous, bold, and innovative team of people.
Well, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to continue the conversation after the show and post it online at democracynow.org. The three co-founders of Black Lives Matter. That does it for our broadcast. You can get a copy of today's show by going to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Steve Martinez, Simon Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Laura Gattas-Diener and Juan Carlos Davila and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Thanks to Elizabeth Press, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Crude, Vesta Gadars. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
The time is now 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present The Yes Men Are Revolting as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Yes Men Are Revolting is a documentary directed by Andy Bickelbaum and Mike Bonanno, which follows the comedy troupe The Yes Men as they stage phony press releases and events to bring attention to environmental dangers and corporate greed. Again, that's The Yes Men Are Revolting, Thursday, August 13th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Summer Concert in Dawson Park, featuring a live performance by Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. The mission of Summer Concerts in the Park is to bring cultural diversity to metropolitan area residents. Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band play a full range of popular and traditional salsa, son cubano, timba, and tropical styles as cumbia, merengue, y bachata. Again, that's the Summer Concert in Dawson Park with Bamba y su Pilon de Azúcar Band on Wednesday, July 29th at 6:30 p.m. Dawson Park is located at North Stanton and North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information about ticket prices and directions can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lentz International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Lentz Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for Kids, a community produce booth open to home gardeners, cooking demos, and live music. More at Lentz Farmers Market. .org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a gunman in Louisiana opened fire in a movie theater last night, killing two people and wounding nine others.
The U.S. Senate tries to block net neutrality rules that were adopted by the FCC.
And we'll have an update on the protests against Shell Oil here in Portland.
This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, July 24th, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. John Hauser, a 59-year-old Louisianan, opened fire in a movie theater last night, killing two and wounding several others. Macy Bro died at the scene, and Jillian Johnson died later in a hospital. When police arrived on the scene, Hauser then killed himself. Firearms were removed from Hauser's house in 2008 in connection with a court order. How he obtained the gun he used last night remains unclear. In addition to a documented history of mental instability, Hauser cultivated an online presence of a right-wing extremism. He called the United States a, quote, financially failing filth farm, end quote, and said that the Westboro Baptist Church was the last real church in the country, voiced support for Greece's neo-Nazi party Golden Dawn. Hauser also posted online comments lamenting the fact that Google search on white power groups returned articles about racism rather than providing ways to join a white power group. Sabrina Siddiqui with The Guardian newspaper pointed out that the shooting last night set off a familiar chain of reaction across the American political spectrum. The state's Republican government requested prayers for the victims. Gun control advocates renewed their calls for stricter gun laws, and gun rights supporters condemned what they viewed as the immediate politicization of a tragedy. Siddiqui quoted that there was little indication that the Lafayette shooting, almost 3 years to the date after the 2012 movie theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, would be a catalyst for any reform.
In an interview with the BBC, President Obama said that the lack of progress on gun control was the biggest frustration of his presidency. The interview took place just hours before the mass shooting in Louisiana.
You know, if you look at the number of Americans killed since 9/11 by terrorism, it's less than 100. If you look at the number that have been killed by gun violence, it's in the tens of thousands.
President Obama said he would continue working on this issue for the rest of his second term, but BBC North America editor John Sopel said that he did not sound very optimistic.
A North Portland resident has engaged in a campaign of racist aggression against his neighbors for the past several months. In addition to calling his neighbors racist names and threatening them, the man has also painted anti-Islamic statements in large letters on his driveway and on his car. The statements call Muslims, quote, maggots and cockroaches, end quote, and are accompanied by handmade crosses and handwritten threats. Neighbors who've called the police when threatened by the man have been told that the person in question has a, quote, right to free speech, end quote. He's not been charged despite multiple threats to kill his neighbors and the possessions of a large stash of guns and weaponry. For more on the problem of Islamophobia in our community, KABU's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Arsalan Bukhari with the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Arsalan, we've been talking about an incident in North Portland in which a resident has placed really racist, Islamophobic signs on his property and is apparently protected under free speech laws. Now, what would you say is the prevalence of this type of activity?
We're seeing a number of hate crimes being reported to our office here in Seattle from across the Northwest, and those are hate crimes where someone has been targeted or property has been damaged. In terms of people expressing a lot of anti-Muslim hate, we are getting complaints nationwide from people who are posting signs in their stores telling Muslims to stay out, and we have people who post signs on their own cars and on their own homes, like what we saw here in Portland. It's getting all too common. I think what people need to know is that American Muslims are their neighbors, often their doctors, their nurses, maybe Muslim persons who are there to help them. And I think if they realize that, they'll have a better understanding of who Muslims are and what Islam teaches and what Muslims stand for. So we're seeing that it happen more frequently. I would estimate on a nationwide level, we're getting an average of one report of anti-Muslim hate crimes per day on average. And these are reported crimes. We always have to wonder, you know, how many more of these things happen where the victim just doesn't know where to turn. That's the state of affairs. It makes us concerned. There's a lot that we can do. So that's the good news. There's a lot we can do about it as everyday people. We can speak out against hate promotion when we see it happening, if we see lawmakers or people, you know, spewing hate from the pulpit, we can call them out. We can simply ask them, where are you getting that information? Ask them to clarify the source of their information. When people see that there is, it's unpopular to put out information that's hateful, they'll understand that promoting it is not the right thing to do. And when people get information based on facts, they act appropriately. They're not inflamed. Their passions are not inflamed. And that's what the average person can do, is call it out when you see hate.
And do you think that this type of sentiment is being fueled by events like the Chattanooga shooting, or is there something else at play?
There's got to be more at play. If it were simply about events, then we would have had a backlash against people who look like Dylan Roof after the attack in Charleston, or we would have had a backlash starting yesterday against people who look like the man who shot up the theater. But it's not about events. It's about the way it's covered and the commentary that follows. And often what we see is that, unfortunately, and we're working on this with mainstream reporters, is to make sure that they use appropriate fact-based labels and appropriate context to not focus on the person's race, religion, ethnicity, because when you do that, you bring the entire community in focus. And then, of course, you have hate crimes against members of that community.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Arsalan Bukhari. He is with the Council on American Islamic Relations based in Seattle, Washington. Arsalan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A concerned neighbor who saw Lagos WIGO employees throwing out large amounts of school supplies this week notified the district and the media. As a result, the city of Lake Oswego has offered to help the district recycle the supplies instead of tossing them in a landfill. The school supplies were located at Palisades School, which was shut down in 2011 because of budget cuts. The school district's financial director told the Portland Tribune that they had contacted Goodwill, the Salvation Army, and City Liquidators, but those organizations showed no interest in receiving the school supplies. After the public outcry about tossing thousands of school supplies into the trash, the city offered to get Lake Oswego Sustainability Network to sort through the items to donate to groups like Schoolhouse Supplies, which gives free supplies to students and teachers who need them.
A rally to save the public postal service is being held this Sunday at 2 p.m. at Northwest Hoyt and Broadway. Organizer Jamie Partridge says that the postal service is under attack from profiteers who want to bust unions. Partridge also says that the rally will try to stop the transfer of public money to Wall Street.
A home demolition in Northeast Portland today has led to protests by the newly formed group Stop Demolishing Portland. The demolition took place in the Concordia neighborhood, which is a hotspot for developers who tear down existing homes to replace them with multiple units. Ken Forcier, who lives in the neighborhood, explains why.
I'm concerned as a neighbor living in Concordia that homes here are being torn down to make way for new construction. Concerned on a number of fronts. First of all, affordable homes are disappearing, many of them unnecessarily because they could be restored. But the most money for a developer is in removing that property and replacing it with two. In this case, the zoning along 30th Ave is R25, 2,500 square foot lots, because there used to be a streetcar line that came up 30th Ave all the way to Ainsworth and then turned around and went back down to Alberta and continued on down Alberta into town. Because the streetcar was on that line, the zoning was more densely zoned at R25 instead of R5, like much of the rest of the neighborhood surrounding this street. North of Killingsworth, most of Concordia is R5, although they're trying to turn the first blocks up to Jarrett into R25 in the new comprehensive plan. The home was demolished between 9 o'clock this morning and about 2 o'clock this afternoon by an excavator with a thumb that attacked it from the rear from the alley and balled it up and stuffed it into the foundation. The developer had said that the home was not restorable, but other people had looked at it and wanted to restore it. In fact, there was one person who offered a standing offer of $5,000 over the highest offer to try and get the home, and instead the real estate agent involved directed it to a developer I believe that's because real estate agents can profit considerably by directing properties to developers who then tear them down and build two, and then one hand washes the other, and they give those listings back to the same real estate agent that found them the property, and that real estate agent ends up selling two new properties instead of reselling just one old property.
That was Northeast Portland resident Ken Forcier speaking about the demolition of an historic home on Northeast 30th Avenue in Portland today. Neighbors say they feel the city has not followed proper procedures. They called for changes in notification and demolition policies by the city of Portland.
Portland is at a halfway point of markedly improved illumination. A year ago, Portland Bureau of Transportation crews began dismantling 45,000 of the city's 55,000 streetlights, replacing them with light-emitting diodes, a process that's expected to be complete by the end of 2016. Cost of the conversion represents an investment of some $18.5 million raised by a general obligation bond. However, it's expected that the completed project will save the city $1.5 million a year in maintenance and energy costs. That means the project should pay for itself in 8 years. The new lighting has already provided a noticeably increased illumination for the city's streets and sidewalks. Transportation Commissioner Steve Novick and Transportation Bureau Director Leah Treat recently accepted an $817,490 incentive from the Energy Trust of Oregon. The trust encourages government businesses and residents to convert lights to the energy-saving LEDs. The new LED streetlights use half the energy of the high-pressure sodium bulbs that they replace and are expected to have a life of up to 20 years. They also prevent carbon pollution to the tune of about 10,500 tons per year.
Capital One, the credit card and banking corporation, has announced the closure of its call center in Tigard in southwest suburbs of Portland. This closure will result in the layoffs of close to 900 employees. The Capital One call center is among the largest employers in Tigard. The company said in a short statement to local Portland media that they've issued 90-day termination notices to the workers. Although Capital One said they'll be offering laid-off workers other jobs in the firm, the company did not disclose where these jobs might be located.
An Arctic icebreaker on contract with the Shell Oil Company is arriving in Portland for repairs tomorrow, and climate activist groups are planning to take to the waves in protest. The Climate Action Coalition 350 PDX and Portland Rising Tide are sponsoring the event, which will begin at 3 p.m. at the Swan Island Boat Ramp at the end of North Basin Avenue. KBOO's Ryan Stroyer spoke with Mia Reback, a community organizer for 350 PDX.
There will be people both at Sunday Parkways and also at the Big Float protesting Shell Nil and raising awareness. Tomorrow afternoon, there will be a public flotilla to, you know, show our public opposition to Arctic drilling and Shell. That will be taking place at 3 p.m. at the Swan Island boat ramp. Shell this summer is trying to start exploratory drilling in the Kutch BC in the Arctic. And one of their icebreakers, sustained some damage on its journey to the Arctic and is coming to Portland for repairs before heading back to the Arctic so they can, if they have it their way, start exploratory drilling. The federal government in a study has shown that there is a 75% chance of a major oil spill in the coming years from Arctic oil development. And this is a really huge problem because an oil spill in that region would be very damaging to the indigenous communities up there and to all of the fish and wildlife. In addition to the immediate risks of drilling for oil in the Arctic, any fossil fuel that is burned is contributing to global climate change, which is already proving to have catastrophic consequences both in the Pacific Northwest and around the world. And in order to avoid climate chaos and the situation from getting worse, all new fossil fuel developments must be stopped, and we must keep these fossil fuels in the ground. I think that all of us together have the power to stop Shell. Unfortunately, the federal government did just grant Shell one of the other permits that they do need to begin exploratory drilling. But we have this great legislation that Oregon Senator Merkley has introduced that will stop Arctic drilling. And so we really hope to kind of unite people, gather them together, send a strong message to our Congress, to our federal government, that people oppose Arctic drilling, also to our local electeds, encouraging them to come out publicly opposing new fossil fuel developments, especially ones as big as oil exploration in the Arctic. And lastly, we hope to just reach the everyday people of Portland. Climate change is an issue that affects all of us. And in order to solve this crisis, all of us must work together. We don't know exactly when it's going to arrive, but it is likely going to be arriving later tonight or early tomorrow morning. There are many different groups and community organizations throughout the city of Portland that are very concerned with Arctic drilling, and there might be some rapid response actions taking place upon its arrival. For people, if they want to stay up to date on what's going on in real time, they can text at ShellNoPDX to 23559 to join a rapid response network. They will receive text updates on the Fenneca's arrival and also actions that will be taking place.
That was Mia Rebeck. She's a community organizer for 350PDX. For KBOO News in Portland, I'm Ryan Stroyer.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy with a high of 72 and a low of 55. Today in history, in 1783, Venezuelan revolutionary Simón Bolívar was born. In 1823, slavery was abolished in Chile. And in 1974, the Supreme Court ordered President Richard Nixon to surrender White House tapes to the Watergate special prosecutor. The quote of the day is from Ursula Le Guin. "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. But then so did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings."
U.S. health insurance company Anthem has announced its plans today to buy out its rival Cigna for more than $50 billion. The acquisition would be the largest ever in the history of the health insurance industry and would result in the largest health insurance company in the country. The companies expect to close the deal in the second half of 2016. Some investors have said that the deal, quote, makes business sense, unquote, and argue that the insurance industry is regulated well enough to function efficiently, even with so few players. They argue that this efficiency will eventually lead to lower premiums. A 2012 study, however, of the merger between Aetna and Prudential found that premiums rose 7% between the merger in 1998 and the survey in 2006.
A funding bill approved by the Senate Appropriations Committee earlier this week includes amendments that block the net neutrality rules the FCC adopted earlier this year. KBOO reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Todd O'Boyle, the Director of Media and Democracy at Common Cause, about the impact of these riders and the strategy behind their placement in appropriations bills.
The rider seems innocuous enough. It says the FCC may not engage in rate regulation, which is something it says that it doesn't want to do and it pledged not to do. But language is written in such a way that it would hamstring the FCC's ability to do all sorts of important consumer protection tasks. like, enforce or go after carriers when they put mysterious fees on the bottom of your bill that you see some $3 charge and you have no idea what that is. They're able to enforce that, and there have been several enforcement proceedings that have gotten those fees taken away and refunded to consumers. The legislation in Congress right now would probably restrict the FCC's ability to protect consumers like that.
How comparable would you say these modifications are to the House bill?
On the House side, there were a few extra. There were a series of three different riders that one way or another would impact net neutrality. And one of them was comparable to the Senate rate regulation. The other two were more procedural and govern the way that the agency operates. All three of them are problematic, and all three of them should be opposed. This is a classic case of trying to use the appropriations process, use the funding mechanisms to sneak backdoor legislation through Congress. Opponents of net neutrality have thrown everything at the FCC to try and reverse the historic consumer protections and free speech protections that we won in February. And what they, having failed by all other means, now they're trying to use the power of the purse to do so.
And how soon might the full body of the Senate vote on this appropriations bill?
It could be as soon as August, but it's really anybody's guess. Part of this is political gamesmanship. We don't know exactly what kind of a deal they're going to strike in the 11th hour to keep the government running. Back in the good old days, when Congress functioned and got bills passed and kept the government funded and operating, but now we deal with fiscal cliffs and government shutdowns and the like, and we always end up with 11th hour, last minute compromise that includes a few riders. We just hope that we keep as many bad riders out as possible.
What do you see as the most expedient route to an open internet being a settled matter?
It feels like it should be settled. We've had this long process, the most public process and publicly involved process in the history of the Federal Communications Commission. 4 million Americans wrote in and shared their thoughts with the FCC on the open internet. We've been talking about this for years, and we finally won historic protections in February. It's really time for the opponents of net neutrality to take no for an answer. Unfortunately, they're using every trick in the book. They're using the congressional appropriations process, and they're suing. So we may be litigating this for years to come. I certainly hope that the lawsuits are dispensed with some dispatch, because we've won this. I think it's time for us to move on and really focus on getting high-value, affordable broadband out across America so that all Americans experience the awesome power of the open internet.
Talk about the role money in politics plays in the ebb and flow of policy development.
It's undeniable that our political system is awash in big money, campaign donations and lobbying expenditures. And it's clear that that has a corrupting influence on the process. I think if you took away all of the corporate ISP money that's infected our policymaking process through pliant politicians at Capitol Hill and in our state legislatures, we really wouldn't be having these conversations. These matters would be settled and done.
So for folks looking for more information pertaining to these ongoing developments, have you a website that you can refer them to?
Your listeners should check out www.commoncause.org and sign up for our email alerts.
Todd O'Boyle, Director of Media and Democracy at Common Cause, thank you so much for taking time out of your Friday to share your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you, Robin.
I've been talking with Todd O'Boyle. He is the Director for Media and Democracy at Common Cause. For more information, you can visit their website at commoncause.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
The Obama administration, according to several sources, will soon present to Congress its plan for closing the Guantanamo military base in Cuba. The U.S. naval base has been used since the opening of the Iraq War 12 years ago to house suspected terrorists. It currently holds some 116 prisoners at an annual cost of almost $1 million per prisoner. Barack Obama promised in his 2008 presidential campaign to close the facility upon taking office. But Congress prevented the closure of the prison, with many Republican legislators and Democrats insisting that the prisoners not be transferred to prisons on U.S. soil. With the new announcement today of the impending closure of Guantanamo, the administration did not say how they plan to get around those objections. Republican Senator John McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, is said to be cooperating with the administration in developing the plan for closure.
The United Nations Human Rights Council is launching another attempt to investigate prison conditions in the United States. The council was prompted by the first recorded incident of sitting president visiting an American penal facility to observe conditions. President Obama toured an Oklahoma prison last week and roundly criticized treatment of minorities in many such facilities. The UN investigators on torture and arbitrary detention have repeatedly been denied their requests for official visits to U.S. prisons. They're most interested in investigating reports of abuses in prisons in California, New York, Louisiana, Arizona, and Pennsylvania.
A 12-year-old child was killed this week when the Mexican military opened fire on unarmed indigenous protesters in a town in Michoacán. The community was demonstrating against the military's detention of a local community police leader. 12-year-old Hildeberto Garcia was shot dead by Mexican soldiers in the indigenous community of Santa Maria Ostula. A 6-year-old child and several others were also seriously injured. The general and head of security in Michoacán was trained by the United States at the infamous School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. U.S. military personnel have used the school to train Central American officers in torture techniques. In this case, the security head claimed that the soldiers shot into the air at crows, but cell phone video footage contradicts the military account. Indigenous activists say that the community police forces do a much better job of protecting them from organized crime and drug trafficking.
Filipino activists gathered in Washington, D.C. last week for an event called the International People's Tribunal. Panels of witnesses and jurors testified on various human rights abuses by the U.S. and Philippine governments during the so-called War on Terror. After 3 days of testimony, a final verdict was presented to the Philippine Embassy in Washington, D.C., but officials would not accept the document. Amira Ladasan is the national president of the Voice of the Moro People. KBOO's Alan Montesilio spoke with her to learn more.
One of those that we presented in the human rights violation